It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin men's hockey coach Tony Granato will be leading the U.S. Olympic team at next year's Winter Games. He'll join the show to talk about his Olympic memories and the hockey culture here in Wisconsin. First, a new report on the issues facing working Wisconsinites shows low unemployment and a steady increase in job growth. That's on the good news side, but this year's report also shows high levels of inequality and racial disparity among those working here in the state. Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of COWS, which released the State of Working Wisconsin 2017 report. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that news on low unemployment. How are we doing there?
Well, probably anybody who's really been paying attention to this, the unemployment rate is down to about as low as it has been since the end of the last century, just below 4% now. So that's a very good unemployment rate, very low.
And then job growth, how are we doing and how does that compare with the rest of the country?
You know, the recession, the Great Recession that happened in 2007, 2008 was brutal, as anybody sort of working or looking at work at the time knew, lost 5 or 6% of the jobs in the economy and really floundered coming back. It's been a slow recovery nationally. It's been a slower recovery in Wisconsin. We're still 34th in job growth over the last 6 years. And so we are adding jobs and we're adding them steadily. And that's good news. Better to have more jobs than less jobs. But we also are not growing as rapidly as the national average.
And what do these jobs look like? How do they look when it comes to wages?
Well, I think we can't tell. The data I have doesn't say that story exactly. But one thing that we do know is that the jobs today are not paying very much more than jobs were paying in 1979. If you look at inflation-adjusted wages from 1979 to current, a worker today working with a lot more education, a lot more productive technology, makes about $1 an hour or more. That's a very slow growth. Wisconsin's growth in wages matches national growth in wages.
And what is driving that slow growth in wages?
Well, there's a couple things definitely going on. One thing we know is that the economy hasn't grown as fast from 79 to now as it did in the post-war period, sort of 45 to the mid-70s. But the other thing that's going on is that we are generating a lot of inequality. And that means workers at the top of the income distribution are seeing wage increases. Workers at the bottom of the income distribution, stagnation, sometimes even declines, and at the middle, very slow growth. So what you have is a pulling apart. So as the economy grows, the inequality in it is growing as well.
And that's a focus of this new report, the inequality you see here in Wisconsin. Spell it out. Give us some numbers on that.
Yeah. Well, one way to think about it is that the top 1% of families in the state bring home about $1 million. The average income for the top 1% is about $1 million a year. The average income for the 99%, the rest of us, is $48,000 a year. That difference is 20 to 1, more or less, which is just below the national difference. But that's a very, and it's growing, that disparity, the average income at the top relative to the median for the other 99%.
And another measure you used was looking at the percentage of the overall state income. Tell me if I had this right, that the top 1% or so bring in. And that is, what, doubled?
Yeah, yeah. So that over the last, I think that one's since 79, the share that's going to the very top 1% has doubled. Wow. The rest, that other half, that is going to the 99%.
And how does that compare to historical levels, that level of inequality?
This is, if you look over time, from the 1950s forward, when income and wages were also growing, inequality was shrinking. But it actually was the last time it was this high was in 1929, just before the Great Depression.
Talking to Laura Dresser about the State of Working Wisconsin 2017 report. And when people talk about inequality and rising inequality, there does seem to be an argument out there. Is inequality inherently bad? If the people at the top are getting richer and I'm staying about the same, should I be worried? Is there something bad overall for the economy if that gap is growing?
I think there's two pieces of evidence I'd think about in answering that question. The first is that there's a lot of evidence that when economies grow more rapidly when economies grow together. So that's from international evidence where other countries have both stronger economic growth and less inequality generating. And I think one of the reasons that maybe relates to the other thing, which is that the more you have extreme disparity, the more you have a set of people who can both afford to and are interested in sort of buying themselves out of the public good. And that can be in terms of policy, that can be in terms of neighborhoods, that can be in terms of, of elections. I think it's destructive in a way to the kind of democratic values when inequality gets too high.
Another thing you've been tracing over the years in these reports is the issue of racial disparities in the economy. What did you see this year?
There's some good news. Wisconsin was posting extremely high rates of black unemployment over the last few years. We've finally seen that come down a little bit. Even so, blacks in the state are nearly three times as likely to be unemployed as whites in the state. And that level of disparity is, 50% higher than the national average. So we are still, kind of excelling at extreme racial disparity. But it isn't in that kind of top of the nation in terms of black rates. Even so, the black unemployment rate right now is about 8 or 9%, which is essentially recession levels for the whole population still.
And then your report includes suggestions to tackle both the income inequality and some of these racial disparities. What kind of things would be at the top of your list?
Well, since it's Labor Day and since we did a little bit on unions, I think there's I've just been looking a lot at a national report on unions and the way that unions reduce inequality, reduce on both in terms of top to middle, but also in terms of racial disparity and gender disparity. So the good news is, there's some infrastructure that helps tie the economy together. Unions are a big part of that. And so that'd be my first suggestion today.
And then you talk about minimum wage laws in the report.
Yeah, minimum wage is another way to kind of help tie the bottom of the labor market into raising the minimum wage, helps tie that into the economic growth that is happening in the state or the nation. And 29 states already have higher than the federal minimum wage. Wisconsin is not one of them. The state of Washington is already nearly at $11 an hour, I believe, or exactly $11 an hour, and is indexing with inflation so that just the workers there can expect a raise. But not so in the state of Wisconsin, where the minimum is still $7.25.
I want to key in on a very specific proposal. A lot of people have very uncertain schedules in the workplace, restaurant jobs, retail jobs in particular, where you don't know what your shift is. Sometimes that week till that day, even you might be sent home. And there's a particular type of state assistance, I think, that wants your schedule 4 weeks out. Can you talk about why this is a problem?
Yeah. So some of the workers who need what we think of as work supports, whether that's Medicaid or Medicaid, which is the access to health insurance through Badger Care, or whether that be subsidies for child care. So workers who need that have low wages, and often inside that low wage job is a very irregular schedule where hours of work are constantly changing and where there's no very little predictability. And given that, a kind of having to tell the state in order to get those benefits that what your hours of work are when they're changing all the time means that people in those kind of jobs just can't get that support to work. They want the hours. They're just not getting them from their employer. And that means they also take the double hit because they cannot get the support from the state to do the work.
And finally, one more recommendation. It has to do with education and job skills training. What are you looking for in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has some good programs, especially in the technical colleges. And I think the more that we build the technical colleges as an access point for working adults of all kinds, and think more about streamlining the remediation and the systems of getting people to feel good about being in school and get through school, I think that's the sort of work we've seen going on in the state. But as resources get moved away from education, and as they have been over the last 6 years, it's getting a little better in this budget, but there have been a lot of hits taken by K-12 tech colleges and the university system all across. And I think a lot of that infrastructure is still reeling. And if you want to really train working people, you got to invest in the system that does.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the group COWS, which just released the State of Working Wisconsin 2017 report. And you can find a link, by the way, to that full report over at the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk to Badger hockey coach Tony Granato about being selected to coach the U.S. Olympic team in next year's Winter Games. Stay with us here on Central Time. From pond hockey in the winter to the elite men's and women's programs at the UW, our state has a rich hockey heritage. So when Olympic officials were looking for someone to lead the U.S. team in the next year's Winter Games, they naturally turned to a Badger. Tony Granato is head coach of the men's hockey team at UW-Madison, his alma mater, and was recently selected to coach the U.S. men's team in the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in South Korea. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You betcha. No problem.
Well, congratulations, first of all. And you've had this amazing career. You played at UW in the Olympics, in the NHL. You've been a coach. How does this honor now, coaching the Olympic team, fit in with all the other stuff you've done?
Well, I can tell you what, when I got the phone call, I was like a little kid. You know, I'm thinking back to Herb Brooks and the 1980 team, thinking, wow, I got a chance to be part of another Olympic team. And it was somewhat unexpected because there was a lot of, still there was discussion on whether or not the NHL guys were going to be able to play. And then obviously sometime in the middle of the summer there, they confirmed that there would be no NHL players playing in the upcoming Olympics. So that kind of put I guess a lot of people in not panic mode, but having to make adjustments on how they were going to pick their teams and who was going to coach and who was going to run them and how they were going to schedule to get ready for the Olympics. So the call came, and obviously to represent your country and be part of an Olympic team is a tremendous honor. I've been there as a player. I've been there as a spectator and fan. I got to watch my sister play in a couple Olympics for the women's hockey team, and I've been there as an assistant coach. So there's nothing better or something that you would be more excited about than get another opportunity like this. So we're excited. It's going to be a great challenge for us for a lot of different reasons, but I think we're going to be able to put together a fun team that will represent us the way all our teams do.
You mentioned that 1980 team, the Miracle on Ice, and the U.S. upset the Soviet team. What did that mean for you as a young hockey fan and player?
Well, I was 15 at the time, and I was in Chicago, and I hadn't been exposed to any international play at all. So I really didn't even know that there was an Olympic hockey team and that we had a U.S. team in the Olympics. So for me, it was an eye-opening experience that, wow, there is hockey in the Olympics, and then bang, the USA team becomes, you know, a team that has probably been the biggest impact on American hockey for sure, and probably the greatest victory in any of hockey. If you look at just the timing of it and you look at the underdog status that the Americans had, because we were all amateurs at the time playing against the Russians' best. And at that time, the Russians basically dominated international play and dominated, you know, any time they were on the ice. So for us as Americans, it was the chance to kind of show the rest of the world that, wow, American hockey can compete with international teams is like Russia and the Canadians and the Swedes and Finns and do really, really well. So it kind of gave us a shot in the arm it's lasted since then. I think that's been the spark that's kind of got American hockey back on the map and kind of got us to be teams that can compete with all those countries.
There's a question I got to ask you. Hockey, like soccer and a lot of team sports, it's something that, you know, if you're on the same team with the same bunch of people, you get this chemistry and this cohesion. You know where the other player is going to be. You know what they're about to do. With this Olympic team, I mean, you're putting together this all-star team of people who maybe have never played together. How do you start building that chemistry when you pull that team together?
Yeah, it's a challenge for sure. Most of the teams that will be in the tournament are running on kind of the same format we are. There are where most of their players will be playing with their teams that they committed to for this upcoming season. So our team will be made up of probably the majority of the players will be coming from professional leagues that are over in Europe. We should take probably 15 or so players from that group of players, and then we're going to take some college players, and then we'll take some players that are on minor league contracts. So, again, all the NHL guys are unavailable, so guys that have signed minor league contracts, though, will be available to us. So we'll have one tournament in November in Germany called the Deutschland Cup. We'll have three games there and three practices, so we'll be together for a week. From that team, we'll probably take, you know, 15 or so of our guys, and the rest of them will be added, you know, just a few days before the Olympics, and that'll include the college guys and the guys that are playing minor league hockey. So it's a challenge that way. We've done a lot of tournaments internationally, whether you go to World Championships or World Junior Championships or World Cups or whatever. There's lots of teams that are put together where you kind of meet at the site and you get a few practices in and you get to play. So hockey's not a real complicated game. So the guys will be ready to play. We'll be in communication with them. From the month, once we get our team together in November, the guys that we pick from that team and the rest of the players that we think will be part of our team, as a coaching staff, we'll be in touch with them, trying to get them to be comfortable with how we want to play when we do get there.
Now, you mentioned a few pools of potential players there. I read that our neighbors to the north in Canada might look at NHL players who have recently retired, and if they're retired, that NHL sort of ban doesn't apply. Any recently retired American players you might have your eye on?
There are a few out there. Brian Gionta is certainly a name that is exciting to me because he's played in international tournaments before and done really well for us. He's fresh out of the game. We've talked to him, and there's a couple other players as well potentially will be available to us. And those guys, you know, the most important thing you got to realize is you can't just open your bag up in 6 months and jump on the ice and try to jump into a competition like that. So the guys that are in that situation that we've talked to have committed to play somewhere prior to either internationally or in the minors just to make sure they're in tip-top shape and ready to contribute. And that's really important.
Talking to Tony Granato, UW-Madison men's hockey coach. He will be coaching the U.S. team in the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in South Korea. Tony, you played for Wisconsin. You were in the pros. You were coaching at the pro level. What went through your mind when you heard this job was opening up for the UW head coach spot?
Well, you know, when I left as a player in 87, the thing that kind of kept me in touch with the program was I had a brother that followed me. Donnie played from 88 to 91, then another brother, Robbie, played from 92 to 95, and then I had a cousin play from 95 to 99 or 98. So for 15 straight years, I was connected with the program, with the family members. So even though I was gone, I still felt that this was, you know, my team or a team I was part of. And I think the one thing that we do have here with the tradition and history of our program is we've got a pretty good brotherhood and fraternity of players that kind of keep in touch with the program even though they've moved on. And so I was always, you know, excited that, you know, someday maybe I'd get back to Madison and not necessarily coach, but maybe be part of the program in some way, shape, or form. So when Coach Alvarez and I had a discussion a year and a half ago now. It obviously got me extremely excited, and I was in a pretty good spot where I think everything from what I've done from a coaching standpoint, I was in a really good spot to have to make this decision to say, you know what, I want to go back to college. I want to be back in Madison. I want to try to help this program get going again. So I'm excited. I had a chance to work with my brother Donnie last year and Marco Siki in our first year back. I thought our players did a heck of a job on trying to get our program back up and running in the way we think it should be running. And I think we have a lot of players here this year with seven new freshmen coming in and a transfer goalie coming in. I think we could make another step in the right direction and get us back, like I said, to the level of play that I think we all expect.
You came to this job from my old hometown team, the Detroit Red Wings. You didn't have to change your wardrobe color, for one thing, all red and white there. What was it like, though, coming from the pros to coaching at the college level?
Well, I think the biggest adjustment maybe, I guess, would be the fact that, you know, you're recruiting a lot younger kids, so the recruiting days have changed since I was a player. We got recruited, you know, it started when you were a junior in high school. And then, you know, you generally found out if you got a scholarship offer your senior year in high school. You know, with today's, the way it's gone today, with a lot of our sports, you know, players are getting offered at a lot younger age. So you're having to evaluate kids that are 14 and 15 years old and try to make decisions on where you think they're going to progress to you know, after their high school graduation. So that's been a little bit challenging, but I also get an opportunity to work with younger kids that also probably have the same dream that I had when I went to college. I wanted to play in the NHL, and I wanted to go to a school that gave me an opportunity to develop and grow as a person and player. So when I did leave the university, you know, hopefully I was ready for that opportunity, and that's what Wisconsin did for me, and hopefully that's what our staff and our program can do for the guys that we recruit and bring into our university.
Now, you're working at a high level here at UW, the Olympic team. Are you still having fun? Is it still the same game it was when you got out, I don't know, on the pond as a kid?
You know what? That's a great question. I can promise you, yes. That's the one thing that, you know, I'm around the game of hockey. I'm back as part of the University of Wisconsin coaching staff. And I find that this is, you know, when you said about adjustment a few minutes ago, we talked about the one thing I wasn't aware is when you come back, and I've been with an NHL team for, I think, the last 30 years until last year, you know, you're part of your team. And when I came back to the university, I became part of something bigger than just coaching a hockey team. The University of Wisconsin Athletic Department and Program, led by Barry Alvarez, has a different vision and different feel to it than a typical professional team. So I'm alongside Coach Chris and Coach Gard, and Coach Shippis and Clark, and all of our coaches on our 22 sports teams. I feel that we're working together to help our program, help our student athletes have opportunities and hopefully, you know, be a positive influence on our great city of Madison. And so I think it's a different coaching position than just a hockey coach, and I really enjoyed that.
Tony, thanks a lot for joining us. Good luck with both your teams.
I appreciate that. Have a great rest of the holiday.
You too. That's Tony Granato, head coach of the Wisconsin men's hockey team, recently chosen to lead the U.S. team at next year's Winter Olympics in South Korea. Coming up after the news, more and more research shows that animals have remarkably complex emotions and social connections. Does that mean we should stop keeping them as pets? Our next guest has written about that. I'm Rob Ferret, a little Olympic inspiration, taking us to the news here on Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how the Department of Housing and Urban Development is doing under the new secretary, Dr. Ben Carson. First, in the United States, an estimated 78 million dogs and 85.8 million cats are kept as pets in the United States. People call themselves parents of their pets and post pictures of their pet children on social media. At the same time, research is showing that animals from goldfish to elephants have surprisingly rich emotional and social lives. In New Zealand, pets are no longer considered property, but, in certain legal ways, sentient beings. In the U.S., pets are still property, but 32 states, along with D.C. and Puerto Rico, include provisions for pets under domestic violence protection orders. Our next guest writes that ethicists are starting to raise the question, is it ethical for people to own animals as pets? Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is a freelance journalist and the author of the book Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. She wrote about the ethics of having pets in The Guardian. Linda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, why are some people, including some ethicists, starting to rethink whether it's right or wrong to have pets?
Well, I think the central question is, especially as we start to consider pets more and more part of our families, that the more you sort of humanize animals, the more it becomes morally problematic to continue to keep them bound to us in ways that we don't really know if they even want. And you know, so there's also, I think, on another level, some ethicists are concerned about how the pet industry is sort of how it works, and what the kind of, you know, collateral damage that the pet industry encourages, you know, from not only from sort of, you know, puppy farms and puppy mills and places like that, but also the sort of, you know, food that they have to eat. Some people keep rats as pets, but other people need to use those rats to feed their snakes. And things like that just start to make the whole thing feel a little bit uncomfortable.
And what kind of changes have we seen over the years and how we humans in the United States in particular think about our animals and our pets in particular?
Well, certainly we've become more, to some degree, and this might not be sort of a nice word to use, but more sentimental about them. You know, certainly within the last 50 years, even the number of people who report allowing their pets to sleep in the same bed with them has risen dramatically. Pets in the bedroom, you know, that really is kind of a newish thing. And, you know, even 100 years ago, having a pet dog, you know, people did have it, but it wasn't, they didn't occupy quite the same sort of niche that pets do now. And, you know, there's a ton of evidence that shows that even, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, people are considering their pets more and more members of their family. And this is a very sort of explicit thing. Now, a lot of the research that says that is coming from the pet industry. At the same time, you know, looking at anything from Instagram to your social media feed, you know, lots of people have pets and lots of people are very, vociferous about how much they love them. So you do get a sense that people at least believe that they're treating their animals more like family members.
And you wrote, I mean, it seems like we used to be more unsentimental even about our pets. You wrote about examples, I think, 50 years ago of people going on vacation and instead of, you know, boarding the dog or figuring out what to do, they might have the pet put down and just replace them later.
Yeah.
That is not, that'd be hard to imagine today.
Absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely shocking. I mean, certainly, you know, looking back with a historical remove on, you know, the farmer in 1698 who killed his dog and baked him for his fat, because the dog had sort of outlived its usefulness at that point. You know, that's a while ago. And you can think like, right, well, people are thinking differently about it now. But even in the 1960s, to have people doing things like that is a little bit, that's a bit close to home. And I think what it shows to some degree is that, pet keeping in the way we're doing it now is a relatively new phenomenon. Now, I know that people are going to quibble with this because there's been, you know, there's a lot of conversation about, in particular with dogs, about, you know, how long it's been that we've domesticated them and things like that. But I think I would argue that the way pets occupy our lives now is in a different position than they did even in the 1960s. You know, even what they were then is different to what we say they are now.
We're talking to Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie about an article she wrote in The Guardian looking at some people, some ethicists in particular, raising the question, is it right for humans to own pets as property? You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Weigh in on this as an ethical issue. Share your story as well. Linda, one of the tricky things here, some of the ethicists you wrote about talk about, you know, animals' autonomy. And I think people might think about animals' happiness. It seems like it'd be hard to measure any of those. These are all kind of human categories, and we're trying to think of how they relate in an animal frame of mind. Is that part of one of the challenges here?
It is one of the challenges, but it's interesting because we have a lot more, we have many more tools available now to be able to assess that in ways. I mean, in particular, I'm thinking of the neuroscientist who basically studied his dog's brain in an fMRI and found so much more than he really thought that he was going to find to begin with. And that was back in 2013. And he wrote an article, an op-ed for the New York Times, saying, claiming dogs are people too. And, you know, increasingly when we start to look at animal behavior, we're seeing a much more evidence of a kind of rich and varied inner life than I think we would have thought before. And certainly, you know, having kind of taken for granted what that's like for them. I mean, you know, looking at turtles love iPads, which is a weird thing, but it's true. And, you know, so do wolves, so do penguins. And the interactions that animals are capable of having and the emotions that they're capable of having, I think we're only now sort of getting to understand. Now, certainly there is concern about reading that in more human ways, anthropomorphizing it, sizing that in ways that might be sort of detrimental to the animal and to how we understand them, you know, implying that dogs feel shame or that, you know, your cat's like, you know, my cat has it. I have a cat. I have to come clean about that. We have a pet. Mm-hmm. But you know, in he's famous for when I am getting on calls with people to start knocking off things from the counter. And it's hard to think that like he doesn't know, but I'm pretty certain he's not doing it just to irritate me, like, you know, or you know, or to make me look bad or anything like that. I mean, because he's still, you know, he's still a cat. Like, so when it comes to kind of moral behaviors and things like that, you know, you don't want to go go too far with it, but it is clear that animals are capable of much, much more than we thought. And I think that brings with it a load of moral questions that we need to ask. I mean, you know, a particularly poignant area to think about, or an animal in particular, are pigs. You know, we know that pigs are capable of empathy. They're capable of knowing that they're about to be killed. And yet the primary, and they make great pets. You know, they're big and kind of smelly, but they make great pets. And, you know, the main reason why we like them to eat them is because they taste good. Now, I'm not a vegetarian. I do eat pigs, but I have to sort of start considering these things. I think that, you know, the more we know about their lives, the more uncomfortable it is to treat them as commodities.
But I think a lot of people, and even just reading the comments section for the article you wrote, would say, you know, maybe there are these moral gray areas, but a pet is pretty well off. They're fed, they're in a comfortable way of life, they're not about to be killed and eaten, and they're not out in the wild getting diseases or eaten by other animals. So can we, I guess, just do that sort of cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. And I do think, you know, there were a lot of people who were saying things like, you know, you'll take my dog's lead from my cold, dead hands. And I thought, like, actually, that's really awful for the animal.
Right, yeah.
Held by a dead person. But I think, you know, yes, it does seem like this is the one area where we do well by animals. You know, we do love them and we think that they love us in return. And I like to think that my cat loves me. I don't know. And we feed them and we take care of them. But I think what's important to know about this is, and to sort of recognize, is that there's no protections for them necessarily in place if we didn't treat them well. Now, obviously, if we're abusing them, you know, there are certainly protections legally within that. But if we're not meeting their emotional needs, if, you know, and I know that sounds a bit sort of silly to say, but I think it's important to note that if we think that they have much, much more going on than we thought before, then if we're not able to successfully meet those needs, is it good for them? You know, if you have a dog that you take out, you know, on walks on the weekends, but he mostly stays at home during the day and he's probably kind of bored, like, is that good for him? Is that a good setup for him? And so I think the important thing also to know about this is that this isn't a kind of question that you ask if you don't care about animals. It's a question that you ask when you do care about animals and you want to make sure that you are doing right by them. So I think a lot of people, when they read the article, reacted sort of very emotionally, like, don't take my pets from me. You can't take my pets. But it's the kind of question that, you know, when you do love your pets, you do want to know that they're happy. But I think ultimately it's, you know, it's the question of, like, can something be happy when it's owned? And we own pets, no matter how much we sort of want to, you know, fuss about the language, we do own them. They are ours. We can do with them almost what we want.
We're talking with journalist Linda Rodriguez McRobbie about the ethics of having pets, of owning animals as pets. As science shows that most animals really have richer emotional and social lives than we had thought, is it right or wrong to keep them as our companion animals? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think of your pet as a person or equivalent to a person? Do you think it's ethically okay to keep animals as pets? If not, what's the alternative? What would need to change? Or are we doing animals a favor by helping them survive in an indoor warm environment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist Linda Rodriguez McRobbie about the ethics of owning pets. As science shows that animals have more complex social and emotional lives than we used to think, is it wrong to keep them, to own them? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your answer to that question. And do you think of your pet as a person? Does your pet think it's people? Do you think it is ethically okay to keep animals as pets? Does it depend on how you treat them, how you interact with them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Mike is on the line in Hartford. Mike, hi there.
Hi there. I just wanted to bring into the conversation a little bit that we're talking about dogs, and I think we need to contextualize it a little bit, only in the sense that the dogs that we have now are kind of a derived animal that we've more or less engineered to have certain characteristics that we desire. And in doing so, we've kind of bred out the, quote, natural, unquote, dog that existed before humans made them our little pets, as if it were. And so I think they've more or less become dependent upon us as much as we've become dependent upon them emotionally.
Mike, I think I get you. Thanks a lot for that that call, Linda. I mean, we've practiced artificial selection on dogs in particular over thousands of years, and the things they've been selected for, maybe herding behavior or things like that, chasing this and that, is what makes them happy now, whether that's what the original wolves were like or not.
Well, I think dogs are a really, really interesting case because a lot of people, and I think there's great evidence for how dogs have sort of co-evolved with us. But I think another really important point and thing to know about dogs is that, so there are over a billion dogs on this planet, but only about a quarter of them are pets. For the most part, most of the dogs on this planet live lives that are probably a bit closer to actually what original dogs would have been like. They're scavengers. They live on, you know, in rubbish dumps, and they live near people and kind of with people, but not as pets, definitely not as pets. And so I think it's interesting because in that way, they've kind of co-evolved with us in the same way that, you know, pigeons have or other animals that live in close proximity to humans, but are not pets. So we think, you know, when we think about dogs, and certainly in the Western world, we think about dogs and we think about them as being our pets because that's how we tend to relate to them. But this kind of co-evolutionary relationship that I think we have with them doesn't necessarily need to be a pet relationship. It doesn't, that co-evolution does not necessitate the relationship that we have with them. You know, so and it's interesting to think of other examples of animals that have co-evolved with us as well, where we would not consider them pets. I think rats and pigeons are great examples of animals that live in and have adapted themselves to humankind, but we wouldn't necessarily welcome them into our homes in the same way.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go next to Caroline, Caroline and Racine. Caroline, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
You know, I just wanted to say, there's no perfect storm and there's no perfect system. We've all lived with animals for many, many years on different levels. But I feel the way, I have a 15-year-old standard poodle and I've had a lot of dogs in my life and she's happy as a clam. She's 15 and old. But if I didn't own her and take care of her, who would? So I just think that we have to make the point that I do think we're getting along better than people are in this world. So that's just it's just my point. I understand the topic.
Caroline, thanks a lot for calling in. And when you talk to ethicists, Linda, who were raising these questions and some of the people who had some of the most severe doubts about this, some of them still had pets and weren't going to, you know, release them into the wild or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, it is a theoretical question, right? Because we have pets and there are, you know, billions of animals that are pets. How we treat them, how we act with them in the future, whether or not we continue to sort of have pets in the way that we do, I think it's kind of wrapped up in these questions. So, I mean, absolutely, you know, with our cat, I don't know what his life would be like without us. You know, we let him go outside and he does come back. So I think he might be happy. But it is a really important point. And part of this conversation is that, well, actually, you know, we do have pets. And so we do have an obligation to the animals that are already in our care. But there are also some questions around that and how we have pets that I think, can be part of the conversation about whether we should have them. You know, it's interesting. When we talk about kind of, you know, keeping them inside or, you know, giving them a warm home and things like that, in the UK, it's a much less fraught conversation to have about if your cat goes outside or not. Most cats go outside. Whereas I think I understand in the States, people are a bit more concerned about the impact that their cats have on the environment and are a bit more concerned about, you know, songbird populations, but also about dangers to their own cats. So they keep them inside more. Well, which animal is happier? Which of these scenarios is considering the animal's happiness? And I don't know, where that sort of falls out. But it's interesting to me to see that there are sort of, you know, cultural differences in terms of how we think of pet keeping and what we think of as sort of the best or most moral way to go about pet keeping.
We're talking to Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, talking about the ethics of owning pets. Some ethicists raising the question, should humans own animals? Back to your calls. Rick is on the line in Twin Lakes. Rick, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Rick?
Like I said to your producer, I'm not my pet's owner. I'm my pet's protector. They're sentient creatures. They understand pain and fear. I'm just there to keep them safe.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. And that reminds me, a question I wanted to ask, Linda, along the lines of what Rick is saying. Is there a way that we can use what we're learning about animals and their social and emotional lives to make the human-pet partnership work better, to be more in the animal's favor, to be more in accordance with their nature?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we are learning more about them all the time in ways that can help people who want to make sure that their relationship with their pet and that their pets are happy. I think that a lot of the research that we're able to do now, you know, even down to if you're going to have a goldfish, what kind of life does your goldfish have? Knowing that they actually do feel a bit more than we think that they do. You know, the story about the turtles and the iPad, it was a bit of research that some animal behaviorists were doing with introducing iPads to turtles and just seeing what would happen. And the turtles seem to really dig the iPads. Like, you can evidently, one of the things you can tell whether a turtle is comfortable or not is how far it extends its head out. And it seemed to be really into it. So if that's the kind of thing that can, say, you know, help alleviate boredom in pets, help alleviate sort of some of the places where we might be deficient, then yeah, I mean, I think the stuff that we're learning about animals is going to simply inform how we treat them. And I think that's a really important sort of step that's been happening over the last 20 years or so.
Well, Linda, if I can ask a personal question of you, since you've been thinking about this and writing it, you have a cat now. Do you think you'll get another pet at some point in your life after looking into this issue?
Do you know, it's a really, really good question. Certainly a lot of this has made me consider the ways in which I treat animals and treat the animals in my life. And, I think one of the first steps before, we probably wouldn't get another cat, just because I think it wouldn't be fair to the cat that we have now. He seems pretty happy being an only cat. I think it would be kind of hard. I mean, we've also got two children, and that was pretty tough on him when they were born. So, one of the things that's made me think about is consuming animals for food. And I still eat meat, but I sort of have to think, like, why do I have a category of animal that equals pet and a category of animal that equals food? And that sometimes some of those, you know, they could be the same. Like, pigs are a great example. That is an overlapping category. And I find it sort of a bit weird and morally uncomfortable the more I think about it, that exists. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it may change the way I feel. It is changing the way I feel about sort of pet ownership and relationship to animals in general, I think.
We'll leave it there for now. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We've been talking to Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. She wrote about the ethics of having pets in The Guardian. No time for you to call in now, but you can still share your thoughts. Do you have pets? Do you own pets? Do you consider yourself your pet's owner, companion, protector, as Rick, who called in, considers himself? Do you wonder about these gray areas our guest has been researching and looking into, between having some pets, some animals as pets, some animals as food, some in overlapping categories? You can share your thoughts briefly at the Central Time Twitter feed at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And also be sure to look for the new, relatively new now, Ideas Network Facebook page. All great ways to share your thoughts on anything we talk about here on Central Time. As a saxophonist, I'm always on the lookout for saxophone news. Now, here's a bit of saxophone playing that was in the headlines this weekend. Doesn't sound too fancy? Well, how about this? The sax player here was performing on an operating table where he had just had a brain tumor removed. This happened a year ago, but it was just written up in a medical journal. Music teacher Dan Fabio from upstate New York was getting the tumor removed. Doctors wanted to make sure that they didn't damage the part of his brain that managed musical ability. Important for anyone, but especially for this music teacher. So they used an MRI, an image, to steer clear. And Fabio hummed during the surgery to make sure the music part lighted up. And yes, that means he was awake through this surgery. And then, after the procedure, still on the table, he was handed an alto sax to make sure his musical brain was still functioning. So that little song you heard was a Korean folk song, apparently. That was the sound of success. He still had that musical ability. Now, I gripe when I have to do a show and I like have a cold or something like that. I will never gripe again about playing the saxophone under adverse conditions after hearing this story. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.